Welcome to This Green Earth. I'm Seth Arnes, and with us today is Dr. Jack Schmidt. Dr. Schmidt is the director of the Center for Colorado River Studies at Utah State University, and he is also an emeritus professor of watershed science. Welcome to the program today, Dr. Schmidt.
Great to be with you.
I was wondering if you could start off by telling us just a little bit about your background. We're going to be talking about the Colorado River water crisis today and just some of your research background and experiences related to the Colorado River.
You bet. I'm trained as a river geomorphologist. That's sort of a branch of geology and engineering that's focused on how rivers work, essentially. And I did my first research trip on the Colorado River in Grand Canyon in the mid-1980s, and then was working on how sandbars formed and how they were affected by operations at Glen Canyon Dam. So I've worked on the Colorado River ever since the mid-1980s. I had a career at Utah State, teaching courses in rivers and river management and river restoration. In 2011 to 2014, I took leave from Utah State and served as the chief of the Grand Canyon Monitoring and Research Center, which is a working group of the U.S. Geological Survey that works on the science of river that underpins river management in Grand Canyon. With my students at Utah State, I've worked throughout the Green River system and elsewhere. When I was with the federal government, we also worked on the issues and developing the Pulse Flow Initiative and implementation of releasing water in New Mexico. So, and then I returned to Utah State in 2014, created the Center for Colorado River Studies, created a project called the Future of the Colorado River, and I guess they can't get rid of me, or I can't get rid of the Colorado River. I've spent most of my professional life working on some aspect of the Colorado River and its management.
I can say as a researcher with less experience doing work in the Colorado River system, it kind of gets in under your skin and hard to turn away from it.
That is for sure.
So I was wondering if you can provide some sort of insight where we are in the Colorado Basin with thinking about this developing water crisis. Where do things stand in the Colorado Basin in terms of water availability, water storage? What are things looking like this year?
Yeah. Well, let's just back up for a second and just acknowledge that the Colorado River, the word that we would use is that the Colorado River is an extensively developed river. In that sense, the size of the reservoirs in relationship to the natural flow of the river, those reservoirs are the largest in relationship to the natural flow of the river of any large watershed in North America. So we have enormous reservoirs, and those reservoirs were built to ultimately provide a water supply for people and agriculture throughout the West. So there's a heavy dependence on the Colorado River. It's important to acknowledge that not one drop of water in any normal year makes it to the ocean, makes it to the Gulf of California. So it is a fully developed river. Now, when we talk about the Colorado River and the crisis, the point that everyone is focused on is, what is the amount of water we have to provide to utilitarian uses? So that's sort of the water supply provided by the Colorado River. That's a different thing than what is the Colorado River today as a river. And so probably as we go on, we might want to distinguish those two. So let's just talk for a minute about the water supply crisis. The easiest way to think about the water supply crisis is to think about it as a bank account. With an income, a balance in the account, and the expenditures from the account. The income to the account is whatever nature gives us. And there's absolutely no question that in a warming atmosphere, in a warming climate, there is less income to the bank account. That's because the soils are drier, the length of the season of evapotranspiration is longer, so the growing season is longer, and so we lose water to plant growth, we lose water to dry soils, less water gets into the system. So we have less income to the bank account. And remember that we're in a system that in which zero water makes it to the sea. So if you reduce the income on an account that you're fully spending, then there's that has an impact. And so in the 21st century, we have consistently consumed more water. We spent more than our income, but we had a large bank account going in. So what that allowed us to do, what we did as a society, including Mexico, was to spend more than our income and drain down the bank account. Now, today, in 2026, our bank account is very low. It's nearly the lowest it has ever been in the 21st century. It's essentially nearly as low as it's ever been since all these reservoirs were built. And so we're now in a case where we cannot rely on the bank account anymore to allow us to spend because we don't have anything in the bank account. And so there's really no option other than to spend less. And that's where we're at. Now, the details of that, which reservoir, how much, who makes the cuts, those are all the nuances. But that's essentially where we're at.
So thinking about that water supply, it's especially dire right now. Lake Powell is less than 25% full. Lake Mead is similarly empty. And we've also had a record poor winter here in the Colorado Basin. Statewide snow water equivalent was the lowest ever in Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and the upper Colorado Basin on April 1st this year. Seasonal runoff forecasts for the Colorado River right now, if they prove out, they'll be the lowest on record. So how does this particularly bad year really push that crisis to the forefront? Like what is the really imminent threat to the system really failing right now or coming close to failing?
Well, first off, it's important to define what we mean by failing. But everything that you just said, I agree with. Let's parse that out a bit. In the Colorado River Basin, maybe 35% of all the water in storage is stored in Lake Mead. Slightly less than that, so maybe 33%. Is stored in a whole bunch of reservoirs upstream from Lake Powell. About 25% of all the water stored in the system is stored in Lake Powell itself. And so we're draining down all parts of that system. And what's going on right now is that, it's always important to realize that the vast majority of the water stored in the system is in Powell and Mead. Those are the two largest reservoirs in the United States. And they produce hydropower, and that water is routed downstream to Arizona, California, and Mexico, and also accessed out of Lake Mead by the state of Nevada. And so the biggest concern is there going to be water enough to supply those big uses? Because the users downstream from Lake Mead use about twice as much water as all the uses upstream. So the crisis is that there would be little water to fall back on, and that consumptive uses in the river would have to be greatly scaled back. Now, there are issues also related to the precise elevation and the precise amount of water stored, especially in Lake Powell. Because if those reservoirs get unusually low or at an unprecedented level, then there's an inability to produce hydroelectricity and an inability to route water further downstream to the biggest users in California and Arizona. It is important, however, when one talks about the crisis and a crash, to always keep in mind that on the one hand, the river is fully used, so society is dependent on that water. But the other caveat to that, or the caveat to that is, more than half of the water in the river is used to produce livestock feed. And the vast majority of the water, you know, well beyond that, goes for agricultural production. So when one talks about the crisis and the crash, one isn't necessarily talking about no water coming out of the faucets of Phoenix or coming out of the faucets of Tucson or LA or San Diego or what have you, but there's going to be an inevitable major impact on agricultural water use in the basin as the system continues to get low. And given all the statistics that you mentioned, we're right at that point. The worst situation we could be in would be to have very low storage and an exceptionally dry year. So it is the perfect storm that we're in. So we're going to have to be faced with making those cuts right now.
So another aspect of the crisis and where we're at right now has to do with Glen Canyon Dam and elevations in Lake Powell. As you mentioned, there's certain elevations that the reservoir needs to stay above in order to generate power. But there are alternative ways to get water out of the dam. There have been some questions about the reliability of the dam in releasing water below the elevation, below that minimum power pool elevation. I did hear Katrina Grants, who is the deputy director of the Colorado River Basin for the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, speak at a conference at the University of Colorado yesterday, and she assured the audience that the Bureau of Reclamation was confident in the alternate way, which are called the river outlet works, to get water out of Glen Canyon Dam should elevations in Lake Powell fall below that minimum power pool. How much do you see sort of this issue of sort of dam management and potential problems with Glen Canyon Dam engineering as part of this kind of really critical point we've reached in the water crisis?
Well, it's absolutely essential for the Bureau of Reclamation to continue to analyze the facility, the ways that it releases water, and it would be presumptuous to second guess that. The first fundamental issue that needs to always be considered is that one can look at Lake Mead and Lake Powell as essentially one gigantic reservoir. Between those two reservoirs is the Grand Canyon. That's 255 river miles between the dam and the beginnings of what was once Lake Mead. And between those two reservoirs, essentially nobody uses the water. So essentially, you've got two giant reservoirs separated by a long scenic bedrock ditch that just happens to be Grand Canyon National Park. And so you could store the water in either place. And so there is, in fact, the amount of water in Lake Powell is a result of a policy decision. The policy decision of whether or not to primarily emphasize storage in Meade, primarily emphasize storage in Powell, or make it 50-50 or any other percentage combination you want. So it's important to keep in mind that the amount of water in Powell and how close Powell gets to these critical elevations that you mentioned are in fact the result of policy decisions of where to store water. You could keep Lake Powell much more full than it is and just have Lake Meade be very empty. You could make Lake Meade very full and have Lake Powell be intentionally much lower than it is. So there are, though, but the important thing is those are policy decisions. Those are not the result, simplistically, of just nature drying out. It's way more complicated than that. Now, the reality is that Lake Powell, right now, the policy decisions have been to move more water down to the lower basin. There's been less water coming in, so Powell drops. Powell has less water, as I said earlier, than the other big buckets in the system. And the way that you release water at Powell primarily is to produce electricity. And you have a critical elevation that you withdraw water at, that water goes through the turbines, produces electricity, it moves downstream, and there's a level at which if you keep taking water out into the into the power plant, as the reservoir gets lower, you start entraining air, and as you entrain air, you'll get cavitation, which will destroy the turbines. And so at some point, you can't do that. At that point, there are other tubes that withdraw water, but those tubes were never designed to be used full-time, and that's what you just mentioned that Katrina Grant's talked about, and Reclamation has assured us that, oh, no, we can do that if we need to. And that is of great concern, and in fact, the lower basin states of California, Arizona, and Nevada have called on Reclamation to do a study to evaluate how to release water at even lower elevations. It is important to realize that when Glen Canyon was built, these withdrawal structures at Lake Powell are relatively high. There is not an ability, the reservoir has not been engineered, the dam has not been engineered to withdraw water at very low elevations. And that's because these conditions that we have today were never contemplated. And so behind the scenes, Reclamation has in fact begun to look at other ways to withdraw water. That would involve significant costs to redrill and lower the ability to take water out to drain Lake Powell even more. But that's a lot of money. That would probably almost surely have to be approved by Congress. Who knows whether any of that would happen? But those are the risks. And so there remains this pressure to keep Lake Powell modestly full because of these archaic elevations at which only water can be released. It's important to note that meanwhile at Hoover Dam, Reclamation keeps engineering ways and retrofitting release structures so that they can produce electricity at lower and lower and lower elevations. So they are doing the work to lower the withdrawal structures. It's Powell that's the real problem of having unusually high elevations at which you need to withdraw water.
So as we've gotten kind of into the weeds on our current situation in the Colorado River Basin in terms of water supply and some of the policy and management decisions around that, I wanted to switch gears for the last part of our conversation and talk about some of the other impacts from low water in the Colorado River system. The obvious impacts you've talked about and we hear in the news are related to water supply, but there's some other interesting and somewhat unexpected things that have happened, especially in Glen Canyon and Lake Powell, due to this nexus of drought, water use in the West, and climate change. Can you tell us about some of those lesser known impacts?
You bet. Because, of course, at the end of the day, the Colorado River and its magical, wonderful remaining river segments are river ecosystems that sustain us and inspire us. From my perspective, if we stand back from the whole basin and we look at what are the big environmental slash ecosystem issues of the basin, the biggest ones are the Delta in Mexico, the Grand Canyon, and the adjacent emerging ecosystems out of the reservoirs that are getting low, Powell and Meade, and then what's going on in the upper basin. So let's just quickly run through those. The Delta in Mexico, once upon a time, was one of the most biologically diverse and productive environments in North America. Now, no water makes it to the sea and no water makes it through the Delta. So guess what? We've destroyed that ecosystem. In the Obama years in 2014, a pulse flow water, a release of water was sent through the Delta. Wonderfully magical event, brought back some life to the Delta, and there are environmental groups who are working to try to get some amount of water back through the Delta. But in a system in which the income to the bank account has dropped, the balance is nothing, then allocating water to the Delta is a phenomenally difficult thing to do. But it would really represent the most enlightened and significant restoration in the system. If we think about the river as Lake Powell, Grand Canyon, and Lake Meade together, then we have the novel ecosystem of Grand Canyon, completely dependent on the rules and policies by which water is released from Powell to Meade. And then we have the emerging landscapes of Lake Powell and Lake Meade themselves. As Lake Powell goes down, as you know, Seth, better than I, there is a spectacular rejuvenation in the riparian ecosystems in the many side canyons that are tributary to Glen Canyon. They're truly magical, wonderful areas, full of abundant life, both of vegetation, beaver, wildlife. They're really spectacular areas and sandstone canyons that made Glen Canyon what it once was. And we have at the head end 5 to 10 miles, depending on the river, maybe 20, where the river is beginning to cut back through its old sediment and rapids are returning to those rivers, and we're getting real legitimate riparian ecosystems right along the river. And so all of that is spectacular as the reservoir gets lower and houseboating and reservoir recreation gets harder. But as the reservoir gets lower, the temperature of the water released out of Lake Powell into Grand Canyon gets warmer. That's just like it was in the old days. But unfortunately now, Lake Powell is full of non-native reservoir game fish that can eat and compete with the native fish that remain in Grand Canyon. And so there is a threat, a legitimate threat, to the viability of the native fish in Grand Canyon by the release of warm water out of Lake Powell, ironically, to make the river more natural, because some of those reservoir game fish are also swept into Grand Canyon. So ironically, as the ecosystems come out of Lake Powell, as Lake Powell gets lower, the river ecosystems, there are threats to the ecosystem of Grand Canyon. Now, it is important to note that Grand Canyon's ecosystem is a novel and unique ecosystem completely dependent on Glen Canyon Dam. And it developed when Lake Powell was full. But now that Lake Powell gets empty, the whole ecosystem changes down there. And there's a real dynamic and conflict between whether the objective for managing the river ought to be to maintain the unique and novel dam-dependent ecosystem of Grand Canyon, or to celebrate the new emerging ecosystem out of Glen Canyon. There is much less interest anywhere, really, in what is coming out of Lake Meade. Lake Meade at the lower 40 miles of Grand Canyon historically has generated much less ecological and citizen interest. And then in the upper basin, just quickly, there are some rivers that are extensively developed. The Dolores River, the Duchesne, the Price, the San Rafael. Those are rivers which have also been devastated by water development, where we could stand to think about how to restore and protect those areas. And we have rivers like the Yampa and the White that are pretty natural and which maintain a tremendous amount of naturalness in their ecological benefits. So those are the puzzles ecologically that all get overprinted on these decisions about where to store water and who to use, who should use the water and where. The reality is that when water is used in the lower basin, it stays in the rivers to get down to the lower basin. When water is used in the upper basin, it goes out of the water system right at the top. And so there is an intersection between water use and the geography of the environment. Sometimes those things get forgotten, but they're all real.
And finally, I just wanted to end our conversation with thinking about the future, putting on your hydrology, climate science hat. What should we expect for in terms of water supply in the coming years, say the medium term, next couple decades for the Colorado River Basin?
Well, again, Seth, you might know more than me about this, but there's no question that climate modeling projects that with a continuing warming atmosphere, the amount of income to the bank account is going to continue to decrease. We're going to have the occasional big snow year, but they have only been one-off years. We have never had two wet years in a row. And even when we have an average year, less water gets into the reservoirs because the soils are so dry. And so the water supply to the system keeps going down, which means we're going to have to learn to live with less. And what is the key to that? Using less. And what is the key to that? A transformation of American agriculture in the basin. We all eat food. We all love pastoral farming landscapes. No one wants to see the demise of rural America. Rural America sustains us. But we're going to have to massively invest in American agriculture here in the Colorado River Basin, so that its footprint, the amount of water used in irrigation, is much less. We're going to have to irrigate less in a targeted way. We're going to have to grow crops that consume less water, are of higher value. We need to emphasize production of garden produce in the winter. When we're talking about producing grass hay and alfalfa, at times when those same crops can be grown elsewhere, that's when we want to ask whether that makes sense. So in living with less, it's going to inevitably involve a massive focus on how we make agricultural use of water in the basin more efficient.
Dr. Jack Schmidt, thank you so much for being on This Green Earth today.
Great to be with you. Enjoyed it a lot.
Thanks for listening to This Green Earth.
If you have an idea, we'd love to hear from you. Give us your ideas and topics, your storylines. It's thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
You can also find us wherever you listen to your podcast. If you like the show and you learn something new, make sure you leave a review. And we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars.